Welcome to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. Conspiracy theories. We've all heard them, and some among us believe them. The CIA killed Kennedy. There's evidence of alien life at Area 51. The moon landing was faked. Why do such conspiracy theories persist, and why are some of us so quick to believe them, while others among us don't take them seriously? On today's show, we will examine these questions. Later in the hour, we'll talk with author John Grant. He's written some 70 books, many science fiction and fantasy, mostly under that pseudonym. His real name is Paul Barnett. We'll talk with him about why conspiracy theories persist, which is one of the topics of his latest nonfiction offering entitled Denying Science, Conspiracy Theories, Media Distortions, and the War Against Reality. First, though, we will explore this issue through the lens of a television series that helped raise the conspiracy theory to an art form. Throughout the 1990s and early 2000s, over 9 seasons and more than 200 episodes, fans of The X-Files followed agents Mulder and Scully, portrayed by David Duchovny and Gillian Anderson, as they examined unsolved cases purported to involve something paranormal, supernatural, or alien. Agent Mulder was a believer in the existence of aliens and the supernatural and in the idea that undisputed evidence of either or both was out there, perhaps being covered up by someone or something. Agent Scully was a scientist and a skeptic who sought to debunk Mulder's work. The series and those characters spawned from the mind of our first guest, Chris Carter, writer, director, producer, and creator of The X-Files. He will be here at the University of Illinois later this week to attend the 30th Insect Fear Film Festival, where an episode of The X-Files will be highlighted along with an X-Files movie, in large part due to a character that Chris Carter named after U of I entomology professor May Birenbaum. More about that later in the hour. Chris Carter, welcome to Focus.
Hello.
Glad to have you with us.
Thank you.
As we begin our discussion, we welcome your questions and comments for Chris Carter about The X-Files, other projects he's worked on in television and film, and about conspiracy theories and theorists and how a series like The X-Files maybe plays into our notions about government and trust, about the supernatural, and about how our own minds seek to explain the inexplicable. You can join our conversation at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu or comment on Facebook or Twitter. You can find us on either site at Focus 580. Chris, how did you come up with the idea for The X-Files?
Let's see. It's a long time ago now. I was inspired by a show that was on when I was a kid called Kolchak the Night Stalker.
And what was that about?
It was about a guy named Carl Kolchak, who was an investigative reporter who investigated cases not unlike those you'd see on The X-Files, which were sort of far out. No one believed him, but he persisted, and it was one of the scariest things I'd ever seen as a kid.
So that's sort of in your mind as you were developing this series?
It was one of the things. Silence of the Lambs had just come out, which I loved, and so you'll see similarities in the character of Scully to Clarice Starling.
Was The X-Files based on or inspired by any other TV series or films or books?
Well, mostly when I grew up with The Twilight Zone, with Night Gallery, Outer Limits, so I think it was really the sort of combination of those things. There just wasn't anything scary on TV, and I wanted to do something scary.
You know, those shows were largely, certainly Twilight Zone, those is the case, anthology series, all new characters and environments in each episode. And The X-Files does have a lot of largely self-contained episodes, but with this continuing thread of two characters seeking to unravel an ever more complicated web of secrets surrounding some of these events.
Yes.
Were you surprised as you got rolling with this series how much it caught on and that people were willing to kind of hang in there through so many twists and turns?
Yeah, I'm still amazed. It's kind of like a dream. We really were kind of writing what interested us, the writing staff, and it just caught fire. And I saw that people loved the conspiracy episodes, the mythologies we call it, and that really became the backbone of the show.
I've got an email question from Kelly. She asks, "How soon did you know you had something special?"
You know, I can say way back to when we made the pilot, it screened for a group of executives at Fox, and they applauded that when the lights came up, which, you know, is something that they don't necessarily do. Their job is to be circumspect. So we knew we had something, at least, that people who spend the money liked. But it really wasn't until, I think, the end of the first season that we knew we were coming back, first of all, and that we would be doing 25 more, so we knew we were on a roll.
When we think about long-running series with some sort of mystery at the center of the storyline, shows like The X-Files, Lost comes to mind, the old David Lynch series Twin Peaks, the longer they air and the more episodes are produced, the more elaborate that storyline becomes. And I imagine the more difficult it is then to bring everything full circle. During the years writing The X-Files, was there ever a point when you said, okay, we've kind of written ourselves into a corner here?
You know, really, no, it's funny. I think that it's a trap. You can write yourself into a corner. You can get so complex that you can never catch the audience up. But I think we did a really good job of, along the way, keeping the audience with us as far as the thread of the mythology goes. But it is a trap, and I think that I see other people have gotten tripped up by it.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. We're talking with Chris Carter, the writer, creator, producer, and director of The X-Files. He'll be on campus this weekend for the 30th annual Insect Fear Film Festival. An episode from The X-Files features a character named after U of I entomology professor Mae Birenbaum, and that episode will be screened along with the film X-Files Fight the Future. There's a link to more information on today's program post at will.illinois.edu/focus, and we'll talk more about that festival with Mae Birenbaum on Thursday. This hour, though, we are talking about The X-Files and about conspiracies in fiction and conspiracy theories and why they persist in real life. We'll get into that as the hour goes along. If you'd like to talk with Chris Carter about any of those subjects or other projects he's worked on, you can call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu or post your questions or comments on Facebook or Twitter. We are on both sites at Focus 580. And we welcome other questions and comments, of course, again at 333-9455, 800-222-9455. We'll go first to Roylee from xfilenews.com. Roylee, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
What's your question for Chris Carter?
Well, recently Gillian Anderson has said twice that Chris has been writing the third X-Files movie script. And I know a lot of fans are really eager to know when we will see Mulder and Scully back in action.
Can I answer?
Absolutely. Go ahead, Chris.
It's a good question. You know, it's been talked about. I can tell you if there were ever a third movie that it would be a mythology movie. It would really sort of be a continuation of what you saw in the first movie. The second movie we did was an opportunity to do something small, much more like what I would call a self-contained episode of The X-Files. We did that, but I think a third movie would get back to the conspiracy, as we call it.
Roylee, thanks very much for the call. And as you might imagine, Chris, we've had a lot of questions come in that are similar. Lisa asking, is there still hope for an X-Files 3 movie? I'd so love to know how the colonization storyline was going to end. David writes, when the heck do we get some closure on that whole alien invasion in 2012 thing? So I guess there are a lot of folks out there that just, you know, that I guess want to see a continuation or conclusion of the main storyline.
Yeah.
I mentioned conspiracy theories at the top of the show, and I'll be talking in more detail about them with author John Grant in the second half of the program, but I'm curious about how seriously some X-Files fans took and continue to take the series. For example, I remember watching episodes of this show with a friend of mine when they first aired, and at the time, I was a fan, enjoyed the show as entertainment. This friend of mine, though, seemed to take it very seriously, almost to the point of thinking of it as nonfiction or as a primer for how to view the world. Today, he routinely shares his conspiracy theories with really anyone who will listen. Why do you think your show resonated so strongly with people that so passionately believe in cover-ups or maybe mistrust the government and that sort of thing?
I think because we didn't just make up a lot of this stuff. We took a lot of it from the conspiracy literature, which there is a lot of out there. There are a lot of websites now devoted to these things. So it's not something that we were just completely winging. So there was a kernel of truth in everything. Also, I think because we based the show in science, it started in science. The science fiction was something that became a sort of what if to the science propositions we would make. So I think that had a lot to do with it. But I think that because we weren't just sort of, as I say, making it up, it was we were drawing on ideas that were out there.
Do you think for a series like this, particularly one that deals with science fiction, maybe a little bit of fantasy, that in order for it to resonate, it has to be based in fact. It somewhere at the heart of it, there has to be some element of it that brings you, draws you back to a more real world.
I think so. It's funny, I resisted the label science fiction when we first did the show because I was so determined to make it a science-based show. I think Steven Spielberg called Close Encounters speculative science. I thought it was closer to that. But, you know, it was science fiction and mostly fiction. Mueller is right, you know, 99.9% of the time, and those were the... that was the science fiction part of the show.
Do you think it serves, when we think about conspiracy and fiction, if it serves to benefit the storytelling to make sure that the conspiracy theorist is occasionally wrong?
Well, you know, if you begin the show and you always know what's going to happen, then somebody's going to be right.
Right.
It's no fun. And, you know, the episodes always turned on an argument, the argument between Scully's science and Mulder's belief in the paranormal or supernatural. It's not interesting unless that argument is a good one.
Well, and that's one of the things I was curious about, whether you were seeking to say anything in those characters. The fact that one is so quick to believe, one so quick to be skeptical about how our brains work when we are faced with events that aren't easily explained, or did you just think this will make for some good conflict?
I just came up with characters that I thought were sort of equal parts of myself. You know, I Mulder had this poster on his wall, I want to believe, and that kind of was me. I wanted a reason to believe. I wanted something that cemented my faith. So I was that... part of me was, or that part of Mulder was me. The same thing with Scully. My brother's a scientist. I have a love of science. So I wanted something that appealed to, or a character that appealed to sort of the more rational part of myself.
Well, and I guess it's safe to say we all sort of have those two halves to some degree. There's a part of us that says, well, let's steep everything in fact and certainty and you know, and work away at proving or disproving things. And then the other half that says, well, but I kind of want to believe in something bigger.
Right.
I've got an email here from Megan who says, one of the things I loved about the show was that the information wasn't spoon-fed to you. She says, you as the viewer had to connect the dots yourself. She asks, were you surprised at how the fans pieced the information together? Was it as you expected, or did the fans tend to head in a direction you'd never considered?
The audience is always smarter than you think they are, and so you don't need to necessarily spoon-feed people. They get it. X-Files viewers, I thought, by and large, were intelligent because they responded to what was two intelligent characters speaking in kind of, I would call it, not necessarily TV-friendly language. I mean, the science was dense. Gillian Anderson used to make fun of me because I used to write such dense scientific dialogue for her. So I think she's right. We didn't spoon-feed the audience. We really were writing what was interesting to us.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and my guest is Chris Carter. He's the creator of The X-Files, and we're talking about the long-running TV series and about the role conspiracy played within its story arc. We welcome your questions and comments for Chris Carter at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu or share your thoughts on Facebook or Twitter. You can find us on either at Focus580. The phone numbers again, 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. Do you think coming of age during Watergate influenced your writing?
Absolutely. It continues to. I was a young teenager when Watergate broke. All the President's Men is still one of my favorite movies. But I think it's also just being a child of the Cold War and reading about it and all the secrets and secrecy surrounding it.
Do you think you would have been less likely to inject government conspiracy specifically into your writing had it not been for events like Watergate?
That's a hard question to answer. I think that certainly my mistrust of government or authority and of leaders was a direct result of my experiences or my indoctrination into things like Watergate.
Has that attitude softened or hardened over the years?
Yeah, it's funny. I think it's hardened in a way. It's especially these days. I just watched the Oliver Stone 10-part series on Showtime, which I found absolutely fascinating, and I found myself excited again in a new way.
How so?
It's an interesting narrative that he creates, and it could be called a conspiracy theory in a way. I was, first of all, it's an interesting history lesson, but it's always interesting to see the way someone else connects the dots.
Would you characterize yourself as a conspiracy theorist?
No.
Okay, so what do you do when you're faced with someone who maybe is an X-Files fan, but is that sort of conspiracy theorist and is drawing from stuff that you have written as fiction and is trying to attach it in some way to the real world?
Run the other way.
I don't blame you. So why do you think the X-Files still remains such a fan favorite? I mean, we are talking now 10 years after the TV series ended, and you've had a couple of films. There does seem to be this fairly intense, continuous following for it, even as there are no new stories being produced. Mm-hmm. How come?
I have always said that I thought the reason for the popularity of the show, and I think the reason for the continued following, is the characters of Mulder and Scully, and also the actors who played them, David Duchovny and Gillian Anderson. I think that they had a kind of, I'll call it, idealized, for me, relationship, which was an intellectual relationship, and I think it was the intensity of that relationship and of the way that those characters were played that has, 20 years out, still strikes a chord.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. We have a few minutes left with Chris Carter, the creator of The X-Files. We're talking about that long-running TV series and about the role conspiracy played within its story arc. And we welcome your questions and comments for Chris Carter at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We have this question tweeted to us. Having spent 10 years on The X-Files as well as the films, did you ever find yourself getting tired of the show or subject matter?
No, it's funny. I never got tired of the show or the characters because I always got to sort of say interesting things through them right through 202 episodes. It was never boring. Was it exhausting? Absolutely. It was, the output was extremely labor-intensive and demanding, and to keep the quality high, you had to you've got a very prescribed amount of time and money to deal with, and you've got to make it great. You've got to work hard every single day. Rod Serling, there's this famous quote when he was doing The Outer Limits. He said, "If he dropped his pencil, he was 2 weeks behind." I know what he meant.
Yeah, we have a tweet from Melissa who asks, given the current surge of politically tied skepticism of science, would you have approached the show differently today?
I don't think so. But I think that it could encompass all perspectives, and I think that's what makes it interesting and made it interesting.
Let's go next to Tony in Champaign. Hi, Tony. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi. I was wondering why Chris said he'd be running away from people who believed in conspiracy theories in real life, because it's a very logical thing to look out for. I mean, when you've got people who are self-serving and power and seem to be, always feathering their own nest and nobody else's, it's logical to think that if they have an opportunity, they'll sell out the rest of us for their own benefit. So I don't understand why he would refuse to see that in reality.
I was being facetious.
Oh, okay.
So I wouldn't literally run away. I was saying that anyone who took what we were doing and tied it into other conspiracy theories was, I thought, making possibly too much out of too little.
So there's clearly there's a distinction between taking elements of fiction that is known as fiction, like your show, and trying to adapt it to reality, and looking at conspiracy theories that exist in the world that maybe have not yet been disproved, right?
I'm interested in the conspiracy theories that are out there, and I'm interested in pursuing them as possibly real. But the X-Files was fiction, and I think that that sometimes it gets lost.
Okay, Tony, thanks for the call. And we have this email from Megan. It says, something I love so much about the show was that the storyline always seemed to circle back to something we could easily believe in. The storylines were based on something that we already knew about science or mythology. One of my favorite quotes from the show being, nothing happens in contradiction to science or in contradiction to what we know of it. And then she asks the question, which conspiracy or science or mythology theme was your favorite?
Hard to say. I'm not sure how to answer that question.
Is there a particular conspiracy out there that you think is rife for the picking in terms of storytelling?
Well, I think the Roswell incident, I was just reading about it recently, so it's sort of fresh in my mind. There's all kinds of interesting ideas about what happened in 1947 in the desert in New Mexico, and where that craft came from, originated, and who was in it, and what was in it, and what survived. That really was the, the heart of our alien conspiracy. And because it's kind of recognized that something did happen, the government position was that it was a weather balloon that crashed there. People believe, of course, that it was a cover story. That, for me, is still an interesting and ripe and rife event.
There's fun in that sort of conjecture.
Yes.
As I mentioned earlier, you'll be attending the 30th Annual Insect Fear Film Festival this weekend on the U of I campus. As I said, we're going to talk more about the festival itself with U of I entomologist Mae Birnbaum on Thursday's show. But she is, in fact, a big reason why you're participating. You named a character after her on one X-Files episode. What led to Bambi Birnbaum?
The episode was written by a writer named Darren Morgan, who wrote four X-Files episodes, all of which were great and are classics. And the one he wrote starring Mae Birnbaum's namesake, Bambi Birnbaum, was called War of the Coprophages, and it was a kind of takeoff on War of the Worlds. I didn't know he had named a character after... I knew he probably named a character after someone, but I didn't know who he had named it after until I got this invitation recently. So that was news to me, and I'm looking forward to meeting Dr. Birnbaum.
Excellent. We'll wrap up with a comment from Ginger, who says, tell Mr. Carter, after 202 episodes, two films, we're still not tired of it either and dying for more.
Oh, great.
Chris Carter is the writer, creator, producer, director of The X-Files. He will be on campus this weekend for the 30th Annual Insect Fear Film Festival. There is more information about that festival on our website. On today's program post, go to will.illinois.edu/focus. Chris, I know you have to go. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And coming up, we will continue our examination of conspiracy, and specifically why conspiracy theories persist in modern America. We'll talk with author John Grant. The prolific sci-fi fantasy writer also delves into science fact, and that is what his latest book is about. It's called Denying Science: Conspiracy Theories, Media Distortions, and the War Against Reality. And we'll have more of your calls and emails as well as our conversation gets underway with John Grant after a short break. This is Focus. This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. We continue our examination of conspiracy now with author John Grant. He's written some 70 books, many science fiction and fantasy, but also some nonfiction, mostly exploring science fact. He has won 2 Hugo Awards, the World Fantasy Award, and a number of other international literary awards, and he's also written under his real name, Paul Barnett. His latest book is entitled Denying Science, Conspiracy Theories, Media Distortions, and the War Against Reality. John Grant, welcome to Focus.
Hello.
Glad to have you with us.
I'm glad to be here.
As we continue our discussion about conspiracy theories and why they persist, we welcome your questions and comments at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu or share your thoughts on Facebook or Twitter. Again, you can find us on either at Focus580. Those phone numbers again, 333-9455, 800-222-9455. How do we define conspiracy theories, and why do they persist?
It's difficult to know exactly how to define them. You know, what I would say is that they're theories which are commonly held, generally by large numbers of people, which have as their basis that there is some sort of, you know, plot or secret being held from all the rest of us by a big group, whether it's a government or a corporation. And that, you know, sort of the people who subscribe to the conspiracy theory feel that they know the truth. You know, like for example, the 9/11 disaster, where you have literally millions of Americans who reckon that this was, you know, sort of set up by the George Bush administration as a kind of false flag operation. You know, if you examine the facts of the matter, then that theory doesn't hold up. But you know, as I say, I mean, conspiracy theories are these generally very illogical theories that, you know, sort of large, powerful groups are keeping secrets from us about, you know, important matters.
For many of us, and I guess maybe perhaps for most of us, when faced with something unknown, we tend to apply some variation on Occam's razor, the notion that among all competing hypotheses for why or how something unknown happens, the simplest explanation, the one requiring the fewest assumptions, is probably right. Why is that not enough for some people who tend to believe conspiracy theories?
To an extent, I think people who subscribe to conspiracy theories are applying a version of Occam's razor. It's often very much easier to believe, or very much more comforting to believe in the conspiracy theory than it is to believe in the rather more mundane reality.
Oh, I wonder also if that has something to do with if it involves someone that the conspiracy theorist perceives to be extraordinary. Take President Kennedy and the Kennedy assassination as a good example of this, or Marilyn Monroe or Princess Diana. Can conspiracy theories kind of be cathartic for folks, that maybe they're motivated by a desire on the part of that theorist to find an extraordinary reason that matches the extraordinary life of the individual associated with it?
Yes, I think that's very much part of it. I mean, the conspiracy theory that's you know, sort of most popular at the moment, or at least it seems to be going viral in all directions on YouTube and the like, is of the extraordinary event of people going to the moon. And, you know, this conspiracy theory is that it was all faked by NASA and Stanley Kubrick, etc., set up in a studio, that it never really happened. And, you know, there, as you say, the conspiracy theory is being latched onto something extraordinary, because it's in this instance, I think, because going back to my earlier point, it's rather easier to believe in the conspiracy theory than it is to accept the extraordinary event.
When you talk about something like the supposed faking of the moon landing, that also points out another characteristic of conspiracy theories. They tend to have to be at all believable, involve a whole lot of people that have bought into that conspiracy and have never said word one to anyone about it.
Yeah, that's what I was just about to go on to, in fact. You know, that with something like the moon landing conspiracy theory, which is a perfect example in a way, that would have had to have involved literally millions of people. And as you say, that none of them over the past few decades should ever have leaked the story of what really happened makes the conspiracy theory quite beyond belief, even if it had been worth believing in the first place.
What are some modern conspiracy theories that maybe make you roll your eyes a little bit?
Well, I mean, the biggest modern conspiracy theory, and the most important, is the one that, you know, the climate scientists of the world have all conspired to hoax us with this notion of climate change. You know, which quite how anybody could believe this outside the pages of a sort of, I don't know, action comic, I find hard to comprehend. But that obviously is a very important and very destructive conspiracy theory. And some of the other ones are very destructive. I mean, just a couple of weeks ago, a bunch of people who were carrying out polio vaccinations in Nigeria were murdered. And this is because there's a conspiracy theory in Nigeria that, you know, the aim of polio vaccinations is not to protect against polio. It's to, you know, it's a CIA plot to sterilize people. So, you know, some of these modern conspiracy theories can be terribly damaging.
What do all of these theories, these examples that we've just cited in these first few minutes, tend to have in common?
As I say, I think they're comforting, and you use the term cathartic. I mean, I think that's part of it. I also think that it's a way of, you know, I think a lot of us are very concerned that there are powerful forces in the world that we can't actually do very much about. You know, if the government does something that we don't like, it seems that there's almost nothing that we can do to stop it, and likewise with the big corporations and so forth. And I think that, you know, the reality is that in the immediate term, we can't do much about it. And I think that the conspiracy theory, in a way, is a means of hitting back at those powerful forces by painting them, you know, sort of in the worst possible colors, you know, so that we if the government does something that we don't like, rather than simply sort of, you know, cursing and spitting or whatever, we start making up a conspiracy theory about what the government is doing, which is 10 times worse than what can be seen in the open. And that sort of, I think, helps us cope with our own powerlessness.
We're discussing conspiracy theories with author John Grant. He's written some 70 books, among his latest, Denying Science, Conspiracy Theories, Media Distortions, and the War Against Reality. We welcome your questions and comments at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455, or you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We'll go next to Paul in Champaign County. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, yeah. I thought this was still the X-Files fellow, but so I don't know, the plugged in the Hollywood sort of thing was I was looking at, because, you know, maybe being British, you wouldn't, or maybe you already discussed the whole truther thing and the 9/11 inside job stuff. I understand in Hollywood, there was an allegation that there was going to be a major documentary out of Ed Asner and crew or something. I don't mean to dismiss that entirely, but because I don't think it was well studied, and we haven't been well served, and you can go to a Frontline episode and actually find the developer saying that they pulled the building 11 or 9 or whatever, the one that people look at as being so unlikely to have fallen 9 hours later or something. And I think there was a insurance fraud conspiracy there, and I think the fact that we don't have transparent discussion of it actually lets us demons grow in the dark or something, I guess, is one of the expressions that's for that. So I don't know if you know about that or whether you have anything to say on that subject. It seems that you're coming at it more from debunking science, and I think one can get in a lot of trouble there, because I think that some of the science is complicated, such as GMO food, the lysergy that goes on to craft these DNA strands together is actually makes that genetic material vulnerable for.
All right, Paul,
anyway,
you're
I'm sorry, I'm digressing, of
yeah,
course, but
a little bit.
But I think I've heard this author debunking fears of GMO, and I don't think that's a fair fairway to go entirely.
All right. Well, I'm sorry to cut you off there, Paul, but I want to give our guest a chance to respond because you raised a few different subjects there. John, go ahead.
When Paul was talking about 9/11 and saying that, you know, we don't really know why the final building collapsed, I think, you know, she's absolutely correct to say that. We don't know. But to jump from the fact that we don't know to saying that there was a definite conspiracy involved, is to me too big a jump. I mean, there are some things that we simply don't know. Assuming a conspiracy as an explanation, is always going to be a sort of weak line of argument. And she was also talking about GMO foods. I must confess that I'm not knowledgeable about GMO foods. I'm not knowledgeable enough about them to be able to discuss that too much.
That's all right. That is actually a subject that we'll discuss in a future Focus program. I promise that for our listeners. Is it your perception that more Americans in particular tend to want to believe in conspiracies?
No, I don't think so. I think that we get a distorted picture of it because I think the American media, of which there are a great deal, tend to give more airtime to conspiracy theorists than those in some of the other countries. But believe me, you know, sort of having spent much of my life in Britain, I know that conspiracy theories are just as rife over there.
You mentioned in the media, what role has the internet played in either?
Oh, the internet is a prime generator of conspiracy theories. I mean, one of the great disadvantages about the internet, I mean, it's got huge advantages. I mean, I use it all the time for research and so forth. But one of the great disadvantages is that you can't really sort out the good stuff from the garbage, so that you can look at a site that claims to be a scientific site, for example. And, you know, unless you're reasonably familiar to begin with the science involved, you can't tell whether it's good science or it's garbage. And consequently, this is fertile ground for conspiracy theories to spread, because literally anybody can create a website with the theory of their own choice. You know, the moon is made of green cheese, and as long as they present it plausibly enough, there are going to be certain numbers of people who believe it.
Some conspiracy theories are ultimately, flatly, unequivocally debunked, and yet never really quite go away. Why do you think that is? Is there a point at which the threshold of evidence should crush any theory that is clearly based on the evidence too outlandish to be believed?
It's really to do with the way that the human mind works. I mean, there have been studies done on this, that for most of us, there will be certain ideas that we get into our heads, and those ideas we will cling to quite irrationally, even if all the evidence that shows they're nonsense is put in front of us. And this happens to all of us. You know, we all have very great difficulties changing our opinions about some things. Conspiracy theories are exactly the kind of thing that a lot of us can have great difficulty changing our minds about, even if it's demonstrated that the conspiracy theory is false.
So do you think there is any way to convince a conspiracy theorist that he or she is just plain wrong?
I think what can happen is that you get sort of, as it were, society-wide tides of opinion change. If for example, lots of people sort of suddenly decide that 9/11 was not a put-up job, then that will persuade some of the conspiracy theorists that indeed there was no conspiracy there. But I think it's a sort of society-wide change that ideas become unfashionable, if you like, that can persuade a conspiracy theorist otherwise. But simply producing evidence, I think in most cases won't.
Well, and I also wonder if there's too much of an attitude towards rationalizing away any evidence that could disprove a theory. I'll give an example that occurs to me. Back in the early 1950s, Senator Joseph McCarthy while conducting those communist witch hunts. He and his team would point to criticism of an alleged communist written in a communist publication as proof that it was part of an effort to protect that individual from being exposed as a communist. So essentially, guilt by disassociation.
Well, oh yeah, I mean, their other trick was that anybody who stood up and protested about the witch hunt was obviously likely to be accused themselves of being a communist. Sort of straight out of George Orwell, really. But sorry, I forget what the question was.
Well, I'm just wondering whether or not there are moments when conspiracy theorists, even when presented with something that should pretty adequately disprove their theory, might find a way to rationalize that as, in fact, evidence of their conspiracy.
Oh, certainly. I remember talking a long time ago with, somebody whose hobby, in fact, their profession, was chasing up UFO reports. And I said to him, well, one of my difficulties with UFOs is that I have never seen any good hard evidence of them existing. And he tapped his nose and he said, well, that just shows how good the aliens are at covering up their tracks. He was perfectly prepared to take the fact that there was no evidence as being, positive evidence.
A common word that will come out of the mouths of conspiracy theorists is the word they, as in they killed Kennedy. They being the forces of world domination, of government, but very nonspecific forces. Are conspiracy theorists motivated by the idea that this they is somehow privy to power or influence or information that the theorist is not, that there's some sort of imbalance they're fighting against?
Yeah, that was, something I was touching on earlier, about how the fact that they, as you say, are the powerful forces, the powerful and secretive forces of governments or corporations. We're getting a buzz on the line.
Oh, we're not hearing it here, but go ahead.
As I was saying earlier, I think conspiracy theories are very much a reaction to they or to them, who are viewed as sort of secretive and powerful forces, whether they be, governments or corporations.
Let's take another call. We have Steve on the line from Watsika. Steve, welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Very interesting show. A couple of quick comments, and then I'll let your guest answer. Talking about conspiracies, I think it's I do think it's fanciful. I think it puts a lot of demons to rest for people. The JFK conspiracy, on the face of it, it seems implausible that one lone gunman could have done something like that. But then it's been proven over and over again that, in fact, it was Lee Harvey Oswald. But it does seem, unbelievable. It's same as the moon landing, that we could actually do this, when actually over and over again it was like, well, yeah, we did land on the moon. But the comment I was going to make real quick is, I think it was on Fresh Air, maybe a year ago, there was a female author about Area 51, and her take on it, I believe I got the story right, was Joseph Stalin put a bunch of little kids in a spaceship and he was going to fly them off to space or invade us or something. I mean, it seemed crazy, and she had all these facts and figures to back it up, and then I never heard anything else about it. So I was just wondering if you guys wanted to comment on any or all of that. Thanks a lot.
And the caller is referring to journalist Annie Jacobson, who wrote a book called Area 51, An Uncensored History of America's Top Secret Military Base. And that was a conversation on Fresh Air from 2011. I don't know if you're familiar with that at all, John.
But with the book?
Yeah,
I haven't. Yes, I'm afraid. I've certainly come across the theory, various different forms of it, that somehow the Russians were responsible, for the Roswell stuff.
And is there any evidence to support it?
Not that I've ever come across. One comment that I did come across, which has always amused me, was that of Leonid Brezhnev, who was the Soviet leader for a number of years, and his explanation was that it had been the Russian discus throwers practicing for the Olympics.
Is there a larger alternative truth behind some conspiracy theories that even if the facts of the matter are conclusive, even if there's no possible evidence to support the conspiracy itself, is there something underlying the desire among some to believe the conspiracy that can tell us something about the conditions in which we live? Well, let me give you an example to sort of consider. Take following Hurricane Katrina, there was a conspiracy theory out there that the Bush administration wanted New Orleans' black population to drown. And it was sort of outlandish, outrageous, but at the same time, there was a clear disconnect between how the response occurred in some neighborhoods versus other neighborhoods, and some saw some sort of racial connection there. Is that an example of how maybe the conspiracy theory itself is a little too extreme, but there's some underlying reality?
There's some kind of kernel of truth. Yeah, I think that is very often the case. I mean, as the caller was saying, there's a kernel of truth in the conspiracy theory about the Kennedy assassination, in that it is difficult to explain how it happened. I mean, it can be shown to be possible, but the explanation isn't very obvious. So if you like, there's a kind of grain of truth sitting in there somewhere. Some of the social ones, I mean, Hurricane Katrina, as you say, was one of them. Again, there's a kind of kernel of truth in what has been going on that the conspiracy theory, in a way, explains.
Let's go next to David in Urbana. Hi, David.
Hello. I have a question you may not be able to approach immediately, but how does conspiracy theory today relate to beliefs in magic and witchcraft and such in earlier ages? Is there some part of the human psyche that is attracted to this type of mystical explanation?
I think very much so, and I think you put your finger on it, that, as it were, belief and fears of witchcraft were, as it were, the kind of low-technology version of our modern conspiracy theories. But, it was a lot easier to believe that, all your cattle had died because the little old lady down the road was a witch and had cast a spell on them, than it was to understand how perhaps, a plague of some kind had struck the cattle. I do think, as you said, it's not conspiracy theories aren't something new to this century. They're just a slightly different manifestation of what the human mind has been doing for four centuries.
You had mentioned, and we had talked about the JFK assassination earlier, and earlier in the hour we were talking with Chris Carter, the creator of The X-Files, and he mentioned a series that Oliver Stone was developing, and that reminded me of Oliver Stone's JFK, that film. And you had mentioned how media plays a role, and I imagine film is a part of that. How can a film like Oliver Stone's JFK sort of muddy the waters when it comes to a conspiracy theory and how people look at something like the Kennedy assassination?
Yeah, I mean, movies and by extension, other forms of fiction certainly can muddy the waters. The biggest example, I mean, going back to the climate change, the conspiracy theory about climate change, the idea that all the climate scientists are practicing a huge hoax on the rest of the world. I mean, a big part of that becoming such a popular conspiracy theory in this country was a novel by Michael Crichton. It was fine in the novel because all kinds of, we can believe temporarily all kinds of foolishness when we read them in a novel. But that particular novel was taken seriously by some readers who thought he was merely fictionalizing some kind of conspiracy that he had himself unearthed. Movies likewise. I mean, JFK, as you mentioned.
Wait a minute. Are you telling me now they can't make dinosaurs out of... out of fossilized remains?
No, apparently they can't.
Oh, he was wrong in that book too. Okay. John Grant has written some 70 books, both fiction and nonfiction, including Denying Science, Conspiracy Theories, Media Distortions, and The War Against Reality. John Grant, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
And we welcome any additional thoughts that you may have about today's program on our website. That's will.illinois.edu/focus. If you know anybody who might enjoy hearing Focus but lives outside of our listening area, let them know we stream the program live every day at will.illinois.edu, where you can also listen back to past programs. It's also available as a free downloadable podcast. Again, that's will.illinois.edu/focus. On tomorrow's show, we will talk about the intersection of mental health and gun violence. Mary Kay Mace, whose only daughter was killed in the shooting on campus at Northern Illinois University 5 years ago, will join us. She'll tell us about the tragedy and what she has and has not seen changed since it happened. We'll also talk with Dorothy Espelage, a professor of educational psychology at the University of Illinois, who studies adolescent aggressive behavior, about what resources are available to young adults and what protocols are in place in case of an emergency on campus. We'll also talk with her about campus behavioral intervention teams that monitor students who exhibit warning signs behaviors. And we'll talk with Tom Pollock, Executive Director of Crosspoint Human Services in Danville, about the unmet need for mental health services in Champaign County and the surrounding area. That's on tomorrow's program. Today's show is produced by Lindsay Moon. Jason Croft is our technical director. I'm Craig Cohen.